Hello, everyone. Welcome back to Progressively Incorrect. My name is Zach Groeschel, and I'm so excited to be talking to Olivia Mullins in just a moment, right after a quick message for all of you listeners that I think it's an opportunity I think you're going to be really interested in. It's the Explicit Teaching Institute with me in New York City in July of 2026, July 27th to July 31st, 5 days of explicit teaching content and rehearsal and practice. I'm just going to put everything I can into that experience and make it just worthwhile for everyone that attends, and tickets are going fast. But just a little bit of background there. Basically, I'm partnering with Inwood Academy for Leadership in the Inwood area of New York City, and we're just going to put on the best thing you've ever seen. If this introduction excites you, check out the show notes. You'll see that there's a link there, and you can sign up and sign up your whole team and come join me for a week-long professional development opportunity. And as you guys know, I have a book, Just Tell Them, The Power of Explanations and Explicit Teaching. I've put a link to it in the show notes, so you can go check it out. And all of Hachette Learning's amazing books, their whole catalog, it's right there in the show notes. Go get yourself some books. Olivia, it is so great to finally have you on the podcast. I've been waiting for this this interview for so long. How are you doing?
I'm doing great, and thank you so much for having me. It's exciting to be here.
I've listened to some of your other podcasts. You've been active lately. You've been doing a lot of advocacy for content rich instruction, knowledge rich teaching, science. What's been going on with you lately?
Well, you know, it's interesting because I feel I've been saying somewhat similar things, although now going more in depth to the science explicit instruction in early elementary. But I think putting it on that Substack has been very useful. You know, everything's in one place, and it helps the catalog. And I see there's some movement and interest in this topic. And so that's really exciting that people are interested in it.
And so it seems like you've fallen into some of the most important arguments, I think, that we need to be having. And if I could be perfectly frank, I go to a lot of schools and they've never heard any of the things I think we're going to talk about right now. It seems like it's sort of, there's a bit of a social media echo chamber where the big topics of the day don't seem to spread or disseminate.
Oh, yeah.
One of those seems to be sort of knowledge rich curricula, content instruction. I'm curious, maybe we can start off with that. Like, what do we misunderstand, and perhaps what is understudied when it comes to content or knowledge instruction in the early elementary years, seeing as we both kind of focus in on that area?
Yeah, and I think there's two answers. So if you're looking from a school perspective, I think so much that we talk about on social media that everyone feels like they've heard a million times has not penetrated into so many schools. From the perspective of maybe the people who are talking about these things, who are thinking about knowledge building, thinking about content instruction, I think what's missed is that the early elementary years are not just a replica. You know, they're not just small. A six-year-old's not just a smaller sixth grader. And there's a bunch of different things. I mean, there's executive function, there's attention spans. But I think one of the most pressing issues is that these little kids cannot read or write quickly, or, you know, in the case of some kindergartners, at all. And so all this discussion about content instruction tends to be kind of assuming children who can read and write, or at least can read and write at or close to the ability at which they can think. But for our kids, they can think at such a higher level than they can express it, or they can read it. And so all these things that people talk about that work for these older students, I'm looking at them and I can't use any of this, or not none of it, but a lot of the techniques specifically. And so when I started learning more about explicit instruction and saying, yeah, this is absolutely what I want to do, there was just no guidance for how to do that in the early years. And then add on with science instruction, you have hands-on activities. I just found there was a pretty big void there.
There's obviously the folks that don't really believe you should teach kids much of anything. So I'll just put those people over there. Then there's the folks that believe we should teach stuff really systematically, and like, this time matters. But maybe it's most important to dedicate the earliest years to learning, like, to read, because that would like unlock a lot of opportunities to then do all of these knowledge building activities that with the power of reading and writing. And then there's like sort of a third way, which is like, look, if you miss out on critical background knowledge by the time you can decode fluently, you've lost something that's cumulative, that was so important, that was so like incremental, that now once you get into texts, you're sort of at a disadvantage in another sort of invisible way. I mean, where do you fall into this? And I do want to follow up by asking you, like, how do we teach content better with early elementary children who cannot read? But where do you fall into this kind of this debate?
I mean, a huge proponent of teaching content, but I'm not teaching a list of facts. You're teaching content in a robust, coherent, cohesive way that's integrated with literacy. I wonder how you can even spend all your day in kindergarten learning to read or in first grade. I don't think you're even supposed to be doing that all day. Phonics is pretty focused, and I think those are actually the grades where there is more time. And so it's funny that when I find our teachers third grade and above, time gets so tight. And it's not that it's not tight for the younger grades, but there's always more room there. Little kids can learn so much, and it is such a waste, not just on the content side, but I will also say on the language side, be just focusing on what they can decode. That is so elementary. Obviously, it's not elementary to have to decode it, that's hard. But the content that is contained in that text is so basic, and they can do so much more. And maybe just as an example, although this is second grade, when they are starting to be able to decode more complex text, but I bring up particles within our properties of materials unit towards the end when we're doing states of matter, and they are just fascinated by it. I have kids just yelling particle at me sometimes when I come in the room. They love to be able to use these big vocab words. They're so interested in it. They get so fixated on, oh, what is the walls made of particles? My bones are made of particles. They can learn so much, and it's such a waste to not teach them that. They're so thirsty for it. And I know the language people also feel that their subject is neglected. And science, I think especially in these early elementary, science is the best vehicle for language instruction. Not to compare science and social studies, but I think as kids get older, social studies is so good. There's so much reading and writing, and it relates to everyday topics. And science start as kids get older starts to get a little more specialized. But in these early days, we are like looking at a tree that's outside. We are looking at bugs. We are talking about a sound around you. It's very concrete, and it has a lot of opportunities for language instruction.
So how do you teach it then? Because like you said, like if you were to go through a bunch of Substacks and look at like knowledge building sort of activities that people suggest, you're going to get like a knowledge organizer. So you're going to get a big matrix full of words that kids can't read. You're going to get mini whiteboards. So you got to have the kids who can write with, and it's kind of squeaky and slippery, and they can barely put together words. And so how do you do this largely verbally in a way that's sticky, that sticks? So, because we also know it seems like kids just seem to go year after year just sort of forgetting things, and I think that's maybe one of the reasons people denigrate knowledge building. What do you suggest?
Yeah, and I'll start with the caveat that I don't know all the answers. I mean, this is what I've been focused on. And I don't think we have all the answers, but I think we do know enough to make it really robust. So last summer, I learned about, or somewhere around there, the Story Champs program, which is an explicit oral language program. And that unlocked something for me because as I was getting more into doing more academic work, which has been the trajectory of my work for the past 5 years, there is something missing from instruction and I cannot figure out what it is. And I think it's that part where, yes, the kids are receiving a lot, right? But we want them to generate also language. And again, we can't do it through writing really, not too much. And so when I learned about Story Champs, I thought, oh, this is the key that's like, this is the component that's missing. And this is also on the heels of there was a, yours and others' advocacy about choral responses. And so those two things combined really showed me, okay, this is how we get kids to generate language and content. And it's so intertwined, I sometimes can't talk about them separately. And with this age, especially when you're looking at kinder and first grade and second to some degree, Story Champs is a little more specific to a story. And so this might be a little bit, this is sort of when you start to integrate narrative structures with the instruction. So it's a little different, but there they have these very simple stories. I think it's like the oral language equivalent of a decodable. And so even though, again, this isn't the main science instruction, what I do is I've been creating little stories Sometimes they're like 10 sentences, and they have the vocabulary and some of the concepts we've been learning about. So if we're learning about vibrations, there's a story about older brothers playing a stereo and it's really loud and vibrating the room. And then the kid, there's a whole setup for how they do turn and talk, and they do the story structure. So you have this really beautiful integration. They're using the vocabulary, they're practicing these concepts. And I'm working on figuring out how to do that for informational text, which is a little trickier, which is more central to the content instruction. And then the choral responses. So I found a lot of success with slides and putting up, a sentence or a word on the slide so you can kind of practice that decoding, just a little bit while they're on there. And what I like about slides over text for very foundational content is the opportunities to respond. You're just constantly having the students respond, and you're able to really build it up in a way that's hard with text, because it would just break up the text too much. You wouldn't be able to listen to it in a coherent way. But with the slides, you can just do one thing at a time. I know you promote this idea of just making it feel easy. And so I did that this year for the first time, introducing properties, the concept of property, which has been difficult actually for second graders. Yeah, sure, they can describe something, but they just don't always connect that to this as a property. And this time I had them in minutes naming properties, saying a property of an egg is, another property of an egg is. I think it stuck. I mean, we've done the first round of our assessments and they look pretty good. Unfortunately, I don't have as much data as I'd like, but it felt like they were using the language during the activity.
You're alluding to like what you've talked about a lot in a lot of your posts about like this kind of like cohesiveness or coherence between these different things. Maybe tell me a little bit about that because I guess on the one hand, you can get stuck in like sort of isolated facts land where just you learn it because you learn it A equals B and you sort of rehearse them and practice them and that might be useful maybe for like sort of in introducing it but after that like what do you do? There's also another realm I loved one of your posts you did where it was like yeah there's knowledge here there's topics there's stuff but you just sort of keep moving and moving. You just go from the next topic to the next text to the next thing, and nothing is self-referring. So maybe tell me a little bit about how you envision kind of like that kind of integrative experience when it comes to knowledge.
And there's so much you can do. I think you're referring to maybe the Substack with the benchmark text, and they have some units that are okay, and then others where it just jumps. Okay is okay, not great. And others that are just jumping from topic to topic to topic. You can look at it at the level of just using text, which I think is maybe step one. And if you're just looking at text, if you are introducing a topic, think about what vocabulary is there. Be careful not to put too much vocabulary in there. What I see with informational text too is like, it seems like no one thinks about cognitive load. It's like, well, if it's an informational text, you can just put 8 million things in there. No, these are concepts. This is hard, especially when the students don't have a record of the information when they are getting read alouds. And then on the next text, you can review in some ways, the earlier information, maybe not saying this is review, but sprinkle it in and then add some more things, add some new vocabulary, repeat the old vocabulary, and keep going on. And so with the benchmark, I showed two examples, one that was just not cohesive at all. And another that I think is kind of what I called faux cohesive, because it gives the appearance of cohesion, but it lacks a lot of what makes something really useful to teach. And now the faux cohesion, if you have a talented teacher, they can tie this together, sure. But we shouldn't be putting all that work on our teachers. But for instance, they would have an article about Mars, and then an article about a star, and then an article about the sun, and these are all things in the sky, but you didn't have repeating vocabulary. You didn't have any of these things tying together. The only theme was observing the sky. And maybe that was in the teacher's guide, but it wasn't even in the text. They didn't even use the word observe in any of them. And they did use words like nucleus. So it's not that they were, and scientists. So it's not like they were only using decodable words. It was kind of the semi-decodable for first grade. And so that's approaching cohesion, perhaps we could say, but it's not there yet. And now I think true cohesion, or I think, for truly learning the content in a really big way, you, especially for science, you need more than just reading about it. I mean, it's especially for science. So you would have the text. And then, as I've mentioned, I think text is great, but I think it's not always the best way to introduce content. If it's what you have, that's great. but you want to pay attention to like how much information is in there and be very careful with it. You don't need to read the book full, you know, if it's 8 million topics. You need to have practice. And so that might be the oral language type practice we've talked about. Worksheets, you know, I always feel like saying worksheet sounds terrible, but obviously you can do a lot with them. And you can build in little practice with decoding or what, reading words. And hands-on activities, which is essential for science. And I'm a big fan of knowledge building, but if there is not hands-on activities in the science, it's not a full science curriculum and they won't learn as well. The example I always use is dissolving. You want to understand dissolving, the students should dissolve something and they should watch it dissolve. And then you should make a little drawing, make arrows to what happened and write little sentences about it if you're older, or say them out loud if you're younger.
I agree. To say that first of all. And I also feel like I have a pretty good view on how to coach someone to run these in a real, you know, the other side of doing experiments or labs or whatever is they're just really like they're poorly set up, they're poorly managed, they're, you know, the materials management, the classroom management. I have a pretty good view on that. So like just assuming the teacher can do all of these things. Why can't I just show them a video of a dissolve of something dissolving and then say, see, now draw the picture, or you know, here's me doing it, you do it, or you know, or let's look at another picture, let's watch four videos, right? Why, what is it about doing it that you think has some intrinsic value?
I mean, you can come from kind of a common sense perspective or a personal lived experience perspective and think about things you've experienced versus things you've seen in a video and the difference in how that sticks in your head. There's also research, and I have read through this. I kind of need to go over it again to be very confident in everything I'm saying. What I've seen, I think, is that what you're describing might work short term, but I do believe there's research that when you do it yourself, it lasts longer. And so when you're looking for not forgetting, right? If you're looking for this to be more than that week, it sticks. And I can look back, you know, at when I was in college and the professor took dental floss and said, you know, this is the size of, I think, DNA in the, you know, in the cell. And that stuff sticks in your head really well. And then I just want to also point out when we are talking about early elementary, these are really basic things. I mean, we are not looking here. Sometimes I think when people hear science, they imagine the high school physics class. I am doing absorbency with the kids. We are talking about like a sound having a volume. Okay. And I mean, and yes, that the vibrations, which is harder to understand, but some of this is so basic that you want students to understand these basic life skills. And with screens now, it is more important than ever to make sure they're moving things. And then, I mean, I see people say bad, oh, I don't want to hear about motor skills, but they're wrong. Motor skills are important. Spatial skills, which I was into for a while, but just lost the bandwidth of it. I mean, a lot of kids, I was just in an event this Saturday, and plenty of kids are just normal. But I do see some kids when you know, there's a triangle space and they're not super young and they have a triangle piece, like a tangram puzzle, but it's like mapped out for them and they are confused. I have seen kids not be able to put an L-shaped block into an L-shaped hole. And so I speculate there are a lot more of these kids now than pre-screens. I mean, after COVID, I do have one like kinder thing where we just play with blocks and I show them about blocks and we build a roof or whatever. It's very simple. There are kids that I felt like didn't know how to play with blocks. You know, like they have not experienced blocks. So I think a lot of times people are thinking about their own childhood. They're thinking about their own kids. And, you know, probably most people in this conversation are very into education, are supporting their children in a lot of ways. They're not always thinking about the kid who doesn't have blocks in the house, who has been raised on a screen, who doesn't have these very basic skills, and they do need to be doing this hands-on stuff in school.
I think many people would agree with you. I'm just thinking of like the integration piece or the coherence with the science. Because here's my example of where this all falls apart. We have I think a renaissance in because I'm a parent and a renaissance of science museums that have lots of hands-on stuff right now. And you go in, you can make bubbles in the bubble room, you can spin tops in the top room, you can do ramps and magnets and you could do everything. And I go in with the educator's lens behind my daughter, and I know what she knows about stuff. And so we go in and we start messing with the ramps, and I know there's an underlying basic principle here about forces or whatever it is. And I would like by the end of this activity that she can articulate something that she didn't already know, right? And at the end of it, she goes, "Sick, let's move on," right? And you go, no, let's read the panel here. Let's read what it says. And she's like, no, I'm done, right?
No,
Like I've already.
it's not in the panel.
So I think that there's a way of teaching science where I always say the magic trick. I say, here's the magic trick. Whoa. All right, next magic trick. And we sort of just go through the motions of like, really, there's nothing, there's no principle or underlying concept that is being learned. Do you feel this? I mean, that's something that kind of bugs me, you know?
Course, I have lots of thoughts on this. You know, I used to, when I started, I do my work through a nonprofit and I do direct programming. We were doing the in-class field trips, and it was, I would say, experiential, meaning it's kind of one-off, it's the spark excitement, and there's a lot of experiential STEM. And I think going to a museum is, you know, 80% experiential, depending on how many panels you're reading, right? Or depending if your dad is what he's forcing you to learn. I had a dad who forced me to do a lot of learning. I was thinking, I'm going to come in and do this stuff that's hard for the teachers to do. And it's even then, when I didn't know much, I knew it's like too jam-packed, there's too much, but you know, I just can come in this one time, and then they can unpack it through their science instruction. So then I learned, oh wait, there some of these schools don't have science instruction. You know, it depends on the teacher. So that's when I started getting in. I guess I'm telling this story because it's reflecting your concern, because that was precisely how I switched what I was doing, because I had that feeling of, hey, this is great. I absolutely believe in joyful learning. I will die on that hill. You know, kids deserve to have fun in school at times, but there should be more. And I don't see that more happening. And so that's when I started getting interested in doing more than these one-offs. I would come like 3 times a year for different topics. And now the program we teach is 12 weeks for second and third. And then even then I'm saying, no, I'm still frustrated with these constraints. I want to do a year-long curriculum. I can see how to do this. So I absolutely echo your concerns. And I think there's a place for experiential learning, you know, like this STEM event I did this weekend. That's kids can come, they have fun, they learn a little bit, they feel happy, they're in their community. But in school, there should be more academic learning. And luckily, students are much more willing to, you know, their standards are much lower for what's fun when they're in the class. I mean, I pull out straws and I get excitement, you know. So what I have learned for hands-on activities, it's hard during the activity to ensure that they're focusing on the salient features. You can try, you can set it up the best way you can, but it's difficult to manage that. So what you really need to do is you need to beforehand prep them to be ensuring they will be focusing on what they're doing, what you want them to be focusing on. And then afterwards, you need to follow it up, and it needs to be in the midst of coherent instruction. So for an example, we do states of matter, and we mix baking soda and citric acid and water, and that makes gas, and it makes a carbon dioxide gas. And of course, you can't see the gas, but you can see the bubble that's created. This is an activity that can very easily, not at all, teach them what you want to be teaching them, which is about gas. And aside, I am also happy for them to experience other things. So I really set it up. We've been talking about air the week before. We talked about properties of air. Now we're expanding it to gases. We've talked about different types of gases. We've talked about carbon dioxide in the bubbles. And when they're doing the activity, they're like, whoa, so cool. I walk around as much as possible and say, what's inside the bubbles? And a lot of kids don't know, even after all that prep, even after, you know, but a lot of them do. Can you see the gas? No, but how do you know it's there? The bubble, what happens? You know, the bubble pops, the gas escapes. And then afterwards, I'm out of time personally because I push in, but many of the teachers do our follow-ups, which have them draw what they were doing, label what they were doing. As a bonus, they get to feel that it turns very cold. You know, they get to observe a chemical reaction. We don't talk about all those things, but once they do that when they get older, now they're primed for that. So that exposure piece is important too. So I agree with you, and I used to do, you know, I've gotten much better thanks to, you know, your help and other people's help of how, oh yeah, we need to be doing this explicitly. We need to be very clear. We need to be saying it over and over and over and over. You know, we talk about farts with gases because that's an example. And I say you have to be mature. We talk about how if you're in the car with your brother and he passes gas and you smell it, and why? Because it's filling the whole space, and you open the window and the gas escapes, and it's a physical, real thing. They did pretty well on the, our first group did pretty well on the assessment. I feel like they get it. I do. I feel like this whole sequence works. So.
So there's a period of like kind of previewing the hands-on activity. There's
Yeah.
obviously a lot of front-loaded knowledge and information that kind of
Yeah.
gives you the context for what you're doing. And then afterwards, there's a period of like what happened, what went wrong, and then sort of unpacking very explicitly what you were meant to see, sort of demystifying it. It just seems so clear. Maybe this is my summer camp background where it was like we had them do stuff, like we had them get on the climbing wall, and we knew during the climbing wall you're worried about your fear of falling, you're worried about the equipment, you're worried about but before they get on the climbing wall we're going to teach them, and then after the climbing wall we're going to teach them, and ultimately wouldn't it be sort of impoverished, I guess you're saying, would that if you just kind of did the climbing wall for them and then afterwards unpacked what happened to you, you know, sort of.
That's a great analogy. Yes. Yes. Yeah. Now I'm going to climb the
It kind of gets us to like something a lot of people have brought up to me. I don't see the conflict at all, but people bring up this tension. They're just like, can you not see, Zach, the as an advocate of explicit instruction or whatever,
wall.
that science needs to be taught differently? And I'm like, I agree that there are elements like we just mentioned. I just don't see the I don't see the incompatibility with explicit instruction. How have you navigated though that thinking?
Yes, and I just want to say one thing before I answer that, because if there's teachers listening and they feel too overwhelmed to do full class instruction, I do want to say a video or a demo is better than nothing, and to not feel bad because it is a lot of work. So I just want to put that in there because I don't want to discourage people from doing, you know, I don't want to make the perfect the enemy of the good. A demo can teach a lot. But okay, so yes, explicit instruction in science. I mean, that has been what I think about probably way too much. You know, NGSS, Next Generation Science Standards, is the United States' major science standards. And it's, I think, in 44, maybe more states, some version of it. And they ask for student-led learning, unfortunately. And there is this argument, it's very confusing because science is an inquiry subject, but that gets confused with the idea of inquiry teaching, which is different, right? I mean, I know there was a conversation where someone said, well, what if you want kids to learn how to ask questions, how to ask good questions? I said, well, you can explicitly teach them how to ask good questions, right? You can do explicit instruction for everything, and then you do want to do that release, which can look like inquiry teaching. I will say there are a lot of elements that I think are important in science instruction that, if you are taking a very, I would say, narrow and rigid and maybe incorrect view of explicit instruction, you might miss. Well, let me give an example. I do have some third graders who did not raise their hand when I asked if they knew what a magnet was. I don't know if this was a language barrier or what, but I imagine there might be some kids who don't have much experience with magnets, even at that age. So I don't do this because of my time limits, but if I had a classroom, what I probably would do is, before I did any teaching about magnets, you could just give them some magnets and they could play around with them. Maybe, I don't know, 5, 10 minute stops, depending on how the class is. And now they have, what you're doing there is now they have prior knowledge, right? They're not figuring anything out really. They're learning, here's a magnet. And I think in that case, that's an example of where experience will trump the words I can use to explain what a magnet is. It's hard for me to explain it if you've never felt that pull. Luckily, most kids do have experience with magnets before we teach it. So if I had kids who hadn't had that experience, I would build that prior knowledge. Then I would teach. Then we would talk about whatever you wanted to figure out. So maybe that's an exception, but I don't really see it that way. I mean, I feel like it's just part of ex it fits into explicit instruction. I feel sometimes people think asking any question at all is inquiry. That's not correct. I think it is important and good to create that curiosity with a question. Well, why, what is air? Is it something? Is it nothing? And kids are like, you know, they're not sure. Oh, wait a minute. You know, well, if it's nothing, how come you need it to breathe? You know, so that creates that curiosity and that conflict and that focus on the salient features. But what I then do not do is spend a whole class or four classes doing ex I don't know how you would do this, but doing experiments to prove that air is something. Now I tell them after a minute, air is something, it's made of particles. And they are so psyched about, I can't tell you how excited kids are about air being made of particles. They love particles. So, and then we do the experiments. And I also get very cranky about this idea that NGSS says that kids need to do what the scientists do, except they ignore most of what scientists do. Even when you are a professional scientist, you are often repeating other people's experiments to make sure they work, quote, in your hands. You are going to hour-long lectures. We don't put, we're not going to put a first grader in an hour-long lecture. They are not professional scientists. We need to treat them for who they are and not try to mimic 45-year-old person is doing in their job that they're paid for. And so this idea that it's not exciting when you confirm someone else's results, I think is just so ridiculous and kind of anti-science if you really start to think about it. It's very exciting to confirm someone else's results. And I think kids like to be right. I mean, little kids love to be right. So if you tell them this is what we think is going to happen, let's see if it happens, and it happens, they are really psyched. And my other thing I'll say on this engagement issue, a lot of this like inquiry-based, we need to get them engaged, I think is based on older students who start to check out. But there is no problem with getting a 6-year-old excited about science. In fact, it's the opposite. I'm like, we want to get them asking questions. I need them to stop asking questions because I'm going to run out of time to do my experiments. So like, this is not an issue. We need to, and this is again like another case, just not looking at little kids as their own for who they are, but pretending they're some extension of a 12-year-old, and they're different. Not to say we should do inquiry for 12-year-olds, but then yeah, anyway.
Yeah, I think maybe like part of it comes with like with the NGSS, with other standards, it and some people's interpretations of even what science is. It's like or science teaching should be the subject itself. It's that there's a lot of sort of process-based verbs. There's a lot of disciplinary knowledge of what it means to be a scientist. There's the fact that the scientific method is like the through line through all of it, which is the inquiry process. And so you kind of get this kind of this. I love that this kind of connects these two things. You kind of get low content knowledge because we're focusing on the general purpose skills that scientists use alongside inquiry based teaching because that's replicating or mimicking the process that a science goes through. And you end up, what do you end up when you do that? What do you end up with?
I mean, yeah, scientists have huge amounts of content knowledge, and they want to tell you all about it. As do little kids. There's a commonality. So I actually kind of look at the process of science almost as just more content knowledge to some degree. One thing I do like about the NGSS is the expansion of what the scientific process is. So it has sort of discarded with the scientific method. I don't agree with that, but I do agree with adding more flexibility in there. I don't know that they name this, but like I used to have a lesson about descriptive science. I mean, that's an important science tradition is describing what you see. Talking about how to do an experiment, how to do a control. You can start doing that and maybe even before, but at least naming it, you can start doing that in second grade if the kids have a strong science background. We're going to look at do these seeds grow? We're going to put water here. We're going to put like salt water on this one, and we're going to control it. Repeated trials. I find I just have done a little of this. Again, I'm in this push-in position, and I find kids do kind of start to get the idea of why you need repeated trials. So I imagine if you took a week or two to focus on that, it would be very successful. And then you can build it in. Again, as we talk about, once you've learned it's not new anymore. So you can build it in for that practice to your experiments as you go on. And what I do actually is I do build those designs in like our third grade, they have repeated trials, and then at one point we name them. And again, I don't quite have time to do as much as I'd want, but by the time we are talking about the idea of repeated trials, they've already been doing repeated trials. I've just directed it. And that's something, for instance, you lose if the kids are supposed to create their own experiment, which is what NGSS wants for everything. I create the experiments, I tell them what to do, and then it's familiar. They're not going to come up with repeated trials on their own, most of them. All right, I'm getting lost in the question. What was the
Well, so, like you said, you could teach a child to do these things
Oh
explicitly, and it kind of reminds me of like I hope I haven't told this story, but oh well, on the podcast. But I watched a fantastic science lesson in which the teacher basically did kind of like a like an Engelmann style like example non-example sequence with erosion. She was like, "This is erosion. This is not erosion. This is erosion. This is not erosion." It was all slides, and by the end of it, it's like, turn to your partner, what is erosion? And then she, get directly gives the definition. And then she goes, so in this tub here, and I'm sure you've done this experiment because I remember it as a kid too. In this tub here, I've got some mud, and in the other tub, I've got some mud, but there's grass and leaves and stuff that are sticking in it, right? Which one is going to erode more? Make your prediction on a piece of paper. And so some people might go, well, you asking that question to make a prediction is an inquiry-based learning experience. And I'm watching the best explicit science lesson of my life, right? And so I don't, what would you say about that lesson?
Yes, and I think ex that's exactly it. And if we went back some years, the worst thing to argue about is when you're arguing and then you have a different definition of the word, right? It's like the most pointless conversation. I do go back and forth, but the point of arguing is to sharpen your thinking, right? And that's just, I find, worthless. So we need to, definitions are very hard. And what I go by now is what NGSS says, because they are the people directing science in this country. And so I use their definition. And they are a little cagey about using these hot, like, inquiry or student-led, but absolutely that is what they, that is the technique, the approach that they promote, even if they are kind of trying to hide it sometimes. So I do have some empathy if people want to call what you're describing in the old days that would be count as inquiry, right? I don't count it as inquiry teaching. It is scientific inquiry. That's very confusing, right? But what why I have just liked explicit instruction and using that framework is that's what was helpful to me to teach. The inquiry guidance was not helpful, and I tried, and it was confusing, and I thought it didn't make a lot of sense, and it was unhelpful. So when I'm looking at explicit teaching now, oh, now I know what to do. Oh, now this is working. If you want to call that inquiry, I guess you can, but everyone's going to be, I mean, I guess we're already confused on inquiry. It's already a problem. Yeah, you could call it mini inquiry or whatever.
And
That's what I've come to
maybe it
call
comes down to like you just said, maybe in the old days that was super hip, right? Like, oh, I'm gonna involve the students in this.
Right.
Like
Right.
like I never was in a class to this day in any content area, whether it was social studies or science, where the teacher said, I'm going to talk about some stuff. You're gonna have a mini quiz at the end. You better get them all right. Tomorrow I will talk about more stuff and you will do a mini quiz at the end. The first time I experienced that was in college with lectures, right? Like I never experienced that in school. And so like I sometimes wonder if that's what it is. There's just this, there's just a
Definitely.
history of bad teaching practices that influence the whole debate. And we have to like remind people like, come with me into the classroom and come and see, are the kids learning new things? Or is their vocabulary changing? Is their thinking changing as a result of it? Or are they playing? And they're not gaining any knowledge as a result of the play. That's always my question.
And when I'm reading these old papers about like inquiry is better, it is very often like an experiment versus reading from a textbook, but not even within a really explicit, instruction focus. And so then those get pulled into meta-analyses where sometimes they say, well, look, inquiry is a better choice, but I'm going, well, yeah, I think hands-on is pretty powerful a lot of the times, right? And how are you even, is this even a good textbook? I mean, honestly, the text I see is often really bad. So it's not what the terminology has changed, and we can't just go look at some meta-analysis. Oh, this tells us this. You have to look at the papers, which, by the way, as an aside, is another thing I've learned. Look at everything yourself if you're going to really be in the area, because a lot of things people say are not right, and it's surprising, to be honest. But that's an aside.
I did have one more question for you that's kind of been on my mind. It's mainly for me around math, but it totally translates into your work in science. And that's that, like controlling language, like ensuring that the same words that may begin as child friendly, but then become the tier two or tier three word, that those words that guide instruction are critical for especially students that fall off the bus pretty quickly and need the consistency of language in their curriculum. What you've been exploring that, I just wanted to kind of kick that over to you. Like, how's that work in science?
And I'll expand that vocabulary and like sentence structure. First of all, I think a lot of words we think of as hard are not necessarily hard. I've talked about particles a lot because I've just been teaching it. Anything that's really naming a noun is not hard for students. I mean, they learn Tyrannosaurus Rex, right? And so we will adults think that's hard because I'm not, it's a little not familiar and not common. But no, for kids, it's just another word. What is a little hard is things that describe abstract principles. So, like I said, property, that was something that is hard. Even though they understand the concept, they have trouble putting the language on it. And I want to point out again, like, if you can't describe something, if you can't use that language, you don't know it as deeply. Because you can't explain it, it affects your thinking. I mean, I think we all have had that experience of being taught a word and then going, oh, that explains this kind of vague feeling I had. And then suddenly it clicks, it makes so much more sense. You can think more deeply, you can share it. And I just would bet anything that that's what happens with children as well. I also find, and I work with English language learners, so basically all my work is done at very high poverty schools. And I'm in San Diego, so a lot of language learners. So this is common to many children, and especially when you're learning two languages at once, which is a pretty impressive feat. I run into sentence structure challenges or kind of vocabulary and, maybe prepositional phrases. So for instance, when teaching first graders about light, I was ha having trouble. And I'm going, why am I having trouble? Well, I realized I was saying the light goes through, the clear plate. They don't understand what going through means, at least not well enough to then understand this other complex concept. So then I changed it to block. It's not blocked by. Well, they were still having trouble with that. So a teacher said to me, I think they're thinking of like a block you play with. So then I added a little demo where a student came up and I told, I stand in front of them and I ask them to walk and they can't, and I say, oh, because I'm blocking your path. And, they kind of giggle. So that was very helpful. And so that kind of broke us through. And I also made a video about going through, going from one side to the other, and sent it to the teachers. And so that's an example of where language kind of blocks, huh? The ability for kids to learn the concept. I mean, another one just happened this last week with sound. And first of all, my lesson was too complex because I assumed that they would kind of know travel a little better than they did, the word travel, sound travels. So we had to add that in. And then while you can get away with not using this sentence structure, the idea of a sound travels from somewhere to somewhere was hard, from and to. And it's not just the sound, because even if they were saying I traveled from home to school, that was very confusing to them. So that's, while there you can get around it, I mean, that's an area where it's a natural way for them to practice this language. And that's why I say, if you want it, people who are saying, knowledge building is no, we have all this other complexity and language and everything. And I'm saying, well, use it. Look at this vehicle that so naturally also finds these issues that kids have. And you can use this to build both content and language at the same time.
Awesome. So, I mean, maybe I could sum up for listeners some of my thinking that's come from this episode. So it's like students that are not reading yet or not strong readers, you're going to rely a lot on visuals through slides, and you're going to use a lot of things like you're going to have oral vocabulary routines, you're going to have sentence starters, you're going to have practice kind of rehearsing some of the terminology, and that has to come through a lot of examples and like sort of demonstrations, like the blocking thing I'm thinking of, right? And then there has to be this cohesion between what is taught and the hands-on element, which also needs to come with sort of just-in-time teaching, of course, but then also this really important follow-up at the end that's going to be like confirming their predictions, looking at the things that happened, it didn't happen. You're sort of overloaded by the experience, or just at least you're consumed by the experience. Once the experience over, you need to sort of bring the language back, contextualize it in the domain of science, build their knowledge and stuff. And finally, maybe to summarize, a lot of the guidance teachers get from the dominant voices in science may try to downplay or minimize the role of explicit instruction, and explicit instruction is very helpful. Is that did I get that right? Do you think?
Yeah, I would say that's a pretty good summary. And I would just love for people to talk more about this and content instruction. When we're talking about knowledge building, we're talking about elementary school, right? We're not talking about 7th grade English teachers. And half of elementary school are these students we're discussing, and maybe more if they're behind grade level. And so I think this is a really important area that everyone should be interested in. So that we should really focus on, and figure out how to do this, because I think there is a lot of information out there and we need to kind of put it together. So.
Love it. Olivia Mullins, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. I will link to your Substack and any other things, your Twitter handle and stuff in the show notes. And listeners, thank you so much. Again, check out the show notes for all this extra information and get in contact. Share this podcast with an administrator, with a friend, with another teacher. I think they'll get a kick out of it. Olivia, thank you so much. Take care.
Thank you so much for having me.